ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app. Hey, welcome to Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National Summer and the ABC Listen app. I'm Natasha Mitchell. This episode was one of our most popular from the year, and for a good reason. I'm joining you from the Queenscliff Literary Festival on Victoria's beautiful Ballerine Peninsula with two men who have found somehow a way to do a whole lot of big-hearted living as they stare down their own mortality. It's a really intimate, revelatory, funny, very generous conversation ahead. Join us. Cancer. It is one of those words that carries such metaphoric weight, doesn't it? The big C, the C word. GP and novelist Peter Goldsworthy describes it as, quote, an insect word that jumps off the page, a death word, a synonym for evil. Peter's memoir, The Cancer Finishing School, started out as a journal but became so much more. Tim Baker is a multi-award-winning author, magazine editor and journalist specialising in surfing culture. His book, Patting the Shark, is also much more than a cancer memoir. It is an affirmation of life, of love, of purpose and a challenge to the medical profession to do things differently, to see the whole humanity of their patients. So join Peter, Tim and me for this episode of Big Ideas. You were, Peter, hesitant to write a cancer memoir. This started as a journal, but as you say in the book, cancer is the ultimate suspense story.
Well, firstly, I had a strange form of denial, I think, in that very inventive form of denial, that was that, gee, I'm a doctor and a writer and I've got cancer. What a gift, you know, for a writer. What great material. And that lasted for quite a while. On the other hand, I was very wary of writing just another cancer memoir. I mean, there are thousands of them, and a lot, and even thousands by doctors, which certainly adds an ironic edge. Stories of my patients over 40 years kept popping into my head, and putting them in sort of in high, not always cancer stories, but certainly high stakes stories, cautionary tales, exemplary tales, tales of courage or tales of stupidity. They also had lessons in them, and that seemed to sort of balance my own narcissistic narrative. I mean, there's a necessary narcissism in cancer. Guess what? It is about you for once, you know. So, and you need that. You need to concentrate on yourself and think about it. But I was wary of writing too much about that, about myself.
And I love how you're learning from your patients throughout this whole process, and we'll talk about that. But this idea that you thought cancer might be a gift, and even actually your first thought was to be quite excited even by the possibility and perhaps a little disappointed if it turned out that as you were sending off your blood samples of yourself to get tested, that it might not turn out to be cancer.
Well, I didn't believe, I mean, I'd had an MRI of my knee. I needed a knee replacement from old ACL reconstructions and things. Sports injuries. And the radiologist who's, you know, I know him, he's seen all of my body from every angle over the years, at Sean. And if I go and have a scan, he'll invite me into his office and we'll look at it. And he said, yes, you need a replacement, but the marrow looks weird and it might be multiple myeloma. Well, the weird irony of that was I'd written on it query MM, which is medical shorthand for, you know, medial meniscus. And I said, look, I just put the idea into your head, because MM also in medical shorthand can mean multiple myeloma. And I didn't believe him for a minute, but I went and had the blood tests all the same, and then I waited a few days, and that was when I went through a whole lot of weird ways of coping, you might say.
And then suddenly you
become... But humour's always been, yeah.
Oh, I mean, there are plenty of laughs in this book too. The humour is delightful.
Well, I'm always going to write about it, I suppose, but it did seem like really good material. Of course, it wasn't great material for my wife, for my family, my children, grandchildren. And so that was a kind of a selfish defence mechanism in a way, but that's what defence mechanisms are. They protect you against, you know, psychological of all kinds, yeah. They're useful.
Tim, for you, writing this book, Patting the Shark, was, for you, an act of self-care. Why?
Oh, I just began as writing therapy, like personal writing therapy, and I guess as a career writer, you know, it is my kind of go-to default way of processing life. And so when I got my diagnosis, it just seemed like a really logical thing to do, to just wake up in the morning and do what I think Julia Cameron calls morning pages in her book The Artist's Way. And so there was no intention of it being read, and so I think that's why it was so kind of raw and candid. And then over time I started feeling like occasionally some morning something would spill out that felt quite coherent, and, you know, sometimes it was just gobbledygook and I didn't kind of, that didn't matter. It was just part of my therapy. But over time I felt like I'd sort of developed this collection of vignettes that might be something, and I sent some to my literary agent and she agreed, and then we sent it to my publisher and she agreed, and then it became a book project.
And then it became a PhD.
And then it became a PhD project. So I embarked on a PhD scholarship, a three-year scholarship, 5 years into what was then a six-year prognosis, in an act of what I call radical optimism. And 9.5 years later,
here you are.
I'm about to submit that PhD.
You are.
Yeah.
That'll be Dr. Tim.
You'll be a real doctor.
Well, I always say I'm not going to be much good in a medical emergency, but I might kind of compose a haiku or something, you know.
Let's go back to that day 9 years ago.
Yeah.
When you walked into the urologist's appointment with your then partner, and what, just describe what happened in that appointment, because it was sort of shocking. Not just for the diagnosis, but also for how the specialist told you.
Yeah, and I mean, I read Peter's book and I'm in awe of kind of how you seem to take yours in your stride, you know, your diagnosis. I mean, I was completely shell-shocked, completely sideswiped. I'm someone who had never even given a moment's thought to the possibility of getting cancer. It had never been a sort of concern of mine, even when, you know, I had tests and those sorts of things. I was just had this naive optimism that it wasn't going to be cancer. And so...
You were fit? You were young?
Yeah, I was a surfer. I wasn't a smoker. I wasn't a heavy drinker. I ate reasonably well. And I was expecting the urologist to say something like, you know, it's a benign enlargement of the prostate. I'm going to write you a script for antibiotics. And instead he slid this bone scan up onto his wall-mounted light box, and there was a large white smudge where my right femur should be. And with a pen, he sort of indicated that smudge and said, this more or less confirms our suspicions. And I also remember him using the phrase, the horse has bolted, meaning the cancer has escaped the prostate and spread to the bone, in which case it's considered incurable and ultimately fatal. Here are some referrals and some scripts for painkillers, and we'll send you to see an oncologist to learn about, we'll get you started on hormone therapy, and we'll send you to an oncologist to, you know, learn more about other treatment options. It was all very perfunctory and felt very abrupt and I guess a bit insensitive, and we just stepped out of that office just reeling, and I was sort of like, what are we supposed to do now with this information and this wad of scripts and referrals?
And suddenly, suddenly you're a cancer patient.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But also you really wrote that your agency was stripped away from you. Like you weren't you weren't given any information about what you could do to support a good outcome.
Yeah, I remember feeling like being sort of sucked into a large machine, was how I describe it in the book.
Yeah.
Not knowing, surely there must be something I can do. I'm young, I'm relatively fit, I'm highly motivated, I've got two young children, 9 and 13, just give me something to do and I'll do it. And the message I was given was, there's nothing you can do other than basically hand over all power to, you know, your treating physicians and submit to these incredibly toxic and sort of emasculating treatments. And so when I learned about the treatment for prostate cancer, the frontline treatment for the most common cancer in the country, which is euphemistically referred to as hormone therapy, I was in disbelief. And I, you know, we all know about chemotherapy and radiation and surgery and all these treatments. And I was like, why have I never heard of this treatment regime that basically suppresses testosterone with a whole suite of really unpleasant side effects, and then not being given any tools to manage those side effects?
Yeah, None at all.
I think there was a cursory, you know, the obligatory sort of information sheet which with a list of potential side effects. But, yeah, not one of my big things is I think exercise should be prescribed as medicine for any man being prescribed hormone therapy for prostate cancer. It's completely nuts that it isn't. I think it's negligent. And I bang on about this to anyone who will listen. And I've had some really great allies in the medical mainstream now who've sort of taken up that message, which is really pleasing. But, yeah, I think no one was talking about hormone therapy because it's really uncomfortable to talk about, and men don't want to talk about the emasculating effects of it.
Mm.
And somehow I just thought, I think this needs to be dragged out into the open, and we need to talk about it because we need to talk about better allied health support to help men manage those side effects.
And the impact of that drug, of hormone therapy to suppress testosterone is enormous, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was shocking to you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to give you a sense of it, I mean, it's called hormone therapy. It's sometimes referred to as chemical castration. And the drug that I was given, Zoladex, it's the same, to give you a sense of its impacts, it's the same drug given to transgender teens who are transitioning from male to female to block the masculinizing effects of puberty. So it suppresses testosterone so that a trans teen doesn't develop masculine traits. But as a man, it has a whole... It's still difficult to talk about. I mean, some of the health implications are it affects cardiovascular health, it increases your risk of diabetes, quadruples your risk of suicide, depression and anxiety, and then, it eliminates libido and sexual function. And, I mean, you collapse testosterone. One of my doctors said men are basically machines that run on testosterone. So I felt like I would never be whole again, how I felt.
You described it as a slow-moving, involuntary gender reassignment.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're very real and physical, those changes that are wrought upon your body. And I've been fortunate that I've been able to use hormone therapy intermittently, so I've escaped the worst of those side effects. And then I've also developed kind of my own self-care regime, which I'm happy to say is now being adopted and promoted by people who've become supporters of mine, like a guy named Declan Murphy, who's the head of urology at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre.
Yeah.
So it's...
I've interviewed Declan. And
wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so much that can be done to make life more bearable under this sort of treatment regime. And so that's just... I seem to have stumbled into a kind of accidental patient advocacy role promoting those kinds of messages.
Author and surfing journalist Tim Baker has rehearsed in his mind all the different ways that first conversation about his diagnosis with aggressive prostate cancer could have been led better by his specialist. Tim and GP and celebrated novelist Peter Goldsworthy are joining me. I'm Natasha Mitchell. This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, and their books Patting the Shark and The Cancer Finishing School about their experiences of being diagnosed with cancer are really beautiful, insightful and actually hopeful reads.
But Peter Goldsworthy, what about you? What was the conversation like for you as a longtime GP who had held the hands, literally in some cases, supported your patients with cancer? What was that conversation, diagnostic conversation, like for you? And also the stripping of your agency as a doctor?
Look, I think the advantage there is, of course, I mean, there's a great uncertainty for most people who get cancer, and what happens now, and what are the different pathways ahead? But for, as a doctor, you know, there's no lack of certainty. You absolutely know what's going to happen and what the odds are. It had held no anxiety for me in that sense.
What did you know about the diagnosis? Tell us.
Multiple myeloma. I knew I'd probably be having a stem cell transplant, being reasonably young, well, 67, sub-70, and my kidneys weren't too bad. I also, at that stage, the five-year survival was about 4 years, so that seemed like I'd get a lot done in that time. I mean, one of the...
Read a lot of books, write a few more.
And in fact, by that time anyway, the five-year survival rates look back. They don't look forward, and I'm 6 years in, and that's what it is anyway by now, and getting longer all the time as the new novel chemotherapy drugs come down the pipeline. Every now and again, I mean, it's so-called incurable. Each drug you take or each treatment eventually fails, but then they put you on the next one, the more expensive one, to the taxpayer.
Yeah,
it's a slightly different paradigm to Marx.
Did you feel in control at that point as a doctor? Did you feel more in control, perhaps, than the average patient?
I wasn't too worried about control. The hematologist I rang when the results came through, Noemi Horvath, had written, he's a little bit older than me, but I'd had myeloma patients that she'd looked after, and I liked her letters. They were straightforward. She's a very straightforward, down-to-earth person. She's not sentimental. She tells you things as they are. But she has a very good sense of humour, ironic sense of humour, and I like her a lot. I mean, she's actually a character. I don't know if any of you have read a book I wrote many years ago. It's called Jesus Wants to Be for a Sunbeam. It's about a child who has leukemia and has a middle-aged female oncologist, hematologist. Just after my diagnosis, there was a stage version of that in Sydney. And the playwright, who I hadn't told it, I'm sitting there waiting for Noemi to ring me one afternoon, tell me when chemo was going to start, and I got an email from Stevie Rogers, the playwright. We need some extra dialogue for the hematologist when the leukemia comes back. What's she going to say? And she was rather like, somehow clairvoyantly I'd created Noemi,
your own specialist.
And so when Noemi, I said to him, "Well, it's funny about that, Stevie. I hadn't told him I was sick, but if I'll ring you back in 2 hours because I'm sure I'm going to have some really good dialogue for you in about 10 minutes." You know. And so I persuaded her. I was in control in some ways because I said to her, "Look, I'm not starting the chemo until I've gone to Sydney for the opening night of the play." And she said, "Well, you can go if your LDH, that's a blood test, hasn't risen." But when I got back, she said, "How was the play?" And Lisa, my wife, was with me. She said, "Well, you should go because you're in it."
I love the way that you borrow from your patients' stories in this book. Mm. And I mean, actually, the love of your patients, as people started to understand your prognosis, your patients started making appointments. I mean, there's one in there that made an appointment just to check on you, actually, which I thought was just beautiful. Another one on the eve of your stem cell therapy, which is a major deal. You know, you're stripping your own body of its immune system, essentially, and repopulating it, turns up in a hot rod to take you for a ride. That's one of your patients.
Yes. Dean, who looks like a bike, he had restored this hot rod. And my hair had gone at that stage, and so there was slightly the bikey and the skinhead in this hot rod cruising down, you know, Anzac, down Jetty Road. I don't know if you know Adelaide, but it had a klaxon and like scaring, you know, women and looks like we're picking up.
The fact that that was one of your patients is just beautiful.
Yeah, I've known him for a long time.
Patients came back to you in other ways too, didn't they, Peter? Because you started remembering patients who you'd lost, and you even then reached into the death files of your patients. What was that about?
Well, certainly the mistakes you've made come back. And weirdly, I think some of them are are amusing mistakes in retrospect, but some of them aren't, and all doctors make mistakes. But the weird thing was, and it wasn't long after the diagnosis, I remembered I sometimes think it's the worst mistake I ever made, and I missed a diagnosis of myeloma about 15 years ago. One of my patients was about 88 or 85, I think. And when I looked back at the time, I couldn't see how I'd missed it. It was obvious, you know. He got to 90, but it had already got into his bones. Mm. which myeloma can, in fact, that's how it was finally diagnosed. And I thought, this was pretty spooky. I mean, I'm not given a supernatural kind of explanations, but I thought when I finally got myeloma, I did think, maybe I deserved it. I wasn't being punished by karma or fate. I didn't think that.
But your mind went there.
But my mind went there, of course. We do. We all think magically at times. Mm. And I certainly, I mean, and with me it's usually a joke. There's another story of magical, sort of magical thinking like that. My younger daughter, who's a psychiatrist, she and a physiotherapist friend started a, it's called Lift Cancer Clinic in Adelaide, and it's a massive kind of mixture of physiotherapy support, exercise, all these modalities, diet, psychotherapy kind of thing. Maybe it, you know, they should have put you onto, Tim. And it's a terrific, but when she, before they opened this clinic in Adelaide at one of the Adelaide cancer centres, her and her mate, she said to myself and Lisa, Dad, could you two come down and we'd like to take photos of you pretending to be cancer patients for the website and the brochure. And so we did that, and they always had two actors in to be the doctor or whatever, which is kind of weird, I'm being the patient. But and so we were sitting on, I told the kids on Father's Day, because that was Sunday after I was diagnosed, and we went out to this Father's Day lunch. And after, you know, we'd gone through all of that, suddenly Lisa, you know, the telling and the talking and the tears and the, you know, love and all that, Lisa suddenly said to Alex, are we still on your cancer clinic, you know, website as cancer patients? And so we had a look, and sure enough, there we were. And Alex said to Lisa, don't worry, Lisa, we'll take you off before the curse strikes again.
My favourite
Photoshop you off.
My favourite story in the book, briefly, is you're riding, you turn to exercise as well, and you're a great big bike rider, and you're riding through...
There's really good evidence. You know,
I think you're riding through a cemetery and you fall off your bike. Yeah. And where do you fall?
I often go to work through the West Terrace Cemetery, which is a lovely, it's a nice ride. And I was running late, and so I thought, instead of going along the road, I'll go between the graves and on this little track. And I knew there was a flight of steps down the bottom. And I thought, well, I'll just fly over those. You know, people do that on television all the time. But of course, I went over the bars, and I ended up on my back after I determined I hadn't broken anything, luckily. I looked to my left, and, you know, in this sort of metropolis of high, you know, high rise, there was one vacant plot right here. And I thought,
you were ready to roll in.
Someone is trying to tell me something. And I mean, in later retellings, I'd sort of, it's a freshly dug whole grave, but really it was just an empty plot. And
Tim Baker, exercise was one thing you turned to. Mm. And you write just beautifully about, you're out there on the ocean with your son. Mm. What did the sea give you at this time?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I've said many times I've never been so grateful to be a surfer, you know, since my diagnosis, because, yeah, my son was 9 at the time. When I was going through chemotherapy, you know, it would be really difficult to kind of get up and decide to paddle out in the ocean, but Alex didn't care. He had this acute case of what I call saltwater fever, and he would harangue me out of bed at the crack of dawn and insist we go surfing, and it was honestly the best thing I could possibly do for myself. And surfing ticks so many boxes. I mean, paddling is this really great aerobic exercise, you know, duck diving waves and taking big lungfuls of air, and then, you know, you sit out the back out beyond the breaking waves and you stare at the horizon just looking for those sort of subtle shifts in the shades of blue that might indicate an incoming swell, and then the riding the wave is just blissful, and, you know, you're kind of humble in the face of a greater power. And I just felt like it just combined so many therapies in one for me. And then I'm there with my son watching him ride waves, and we're hooting each other into waves. And there's dolphins, you know, it really is an experience that allowed me to feel connected to my previous life, and it allowed me to feel really grateful at a time when I could have easily wallowed in self-pity.
And there was wallowing. But you were incredibly proactive, and maybe that you're telling that story in retrospect, but it sounds like, I mean, pretty much you tried everything. Mm. Meditation, you're a big meditator, and I guess it's a lot of surfers, I think, have a meditative nature.
Yeah, I think it's inherent in the, I think of surfing as an active form of meditation, because you can't have thoughts while you're riding a wave. because it's so spontaneous, you're so in the moment. Mm. So it is kind of like an active form of meditation. But, yeah, I became quite a dedicated meditator on land as well.
And Vipassana retreats, meditation retreats, cancer weekends away, like the Ian Gawler Foundations.
Ian Gawler's retreats.
Psychedelics.
Yeah.
Cannabis, crossing the border during COVID to get cannabinoid oil, I think. I mean, tell us what all that was about and what that brought back to you. What landed as meaningful and purposeful helpful at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I was so determined to live as long as I could. I'd been told to expect 5 or 6 years survival time, and I set myself the goal of 10 because my kids were 9 and 13 and I wanted to see them to adulthood. And I think what sometimes gets lost is what I did do was have the most aggressive treatment options possible. So I had hormone therapy combined with early chemotherapy because there'd been big clinical trials to show improved survival times with that doublet treatment. But then I just did everything I could to manage side effects. So meditation was really obvious to me that I would need to be able to quieten the anxious mind and find a place of peace and stillness. Surfing was a no-brainer, writing therapy. And then a friend sent me some medicinal cannabis oil through the mail, which amazingly got through the Australia Post system undetected. And that just was a real godsend, particularly during chemotherapy. It allowed me to sleep really well. It helped manage a lot of the side effects of chemo. And then I discovered...
Helps manage nausea.
Yeah, exactly. And also when I was become a bit of a clean living freak, you know, it was nice to have one indulgence.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed it. I wasn't drinking alcohol. I didn't want to smoke cannabis. I wasn't a big pot smoker at the time. I had been in my youth.
Yeah.
But it was a nice way to take it without smoking.
And we make it so damn hard in Australia to get medical cannabis, don't we?
Yeah, well, I've seen it improve greatly over that 9 to 10 years. It's much more normalised. And, yeah, that gave great benefit. Then I discovered the research around psychedelic therapy through a book by a guy named Michael Pollan called How to Change Your Mind. And I was suffering from depression at the time. I'd been prescribed antidepressants, which is very common under the effects of hormone therapy. And that gave me profound and long-term benefit. And then I became a great advocate for the benefits of psychedelic therapy. I
was microdosing psychedelics. Tell us about that experience and what it gave you.
Microdosing specifically.
Also the psilocybin experience. That was pretty wild. You took yourself on a trip.
Yeah. I mean, I found myself a sort of underground psychedelic therapist, appropriately enough, in northern New South Wales, in this little sort of community property inland from Byron Bay. The first time I did it, I had MDMA, which is commonly known as ecstasy, and that was a really pleasant experience. And with psychedelic therapy, they talk about set and setting. So you set an intention, a very specific intention with a sort of therapeutic sort of idea, and then you need to be in a really safe, supporting setting. And I felt like I had some sort of PTSD from the way my diagnosis was delivered. And so my intention was to go back to that moment of receiving my diagnosis and kind of release whatever trauma I might have been carrying. And under the influence of the psychedelic drug in this therapy session, I took myself back to the moment of receiving my diagnosis, sitting opposite the urologist, and I just felt overwhelming compassion for him.
Mm.
I just thought, you poor man, it must be such a tough job to have to sit here and deliver that kind of news to someone. And so it completely flipped the script.
Amazing.
For me.
Yeah.
And I think that's had really lasting benefits. And then, the recommendation was then to try psilocybin, and that was specifically with the idea of making peace with my mortality because, you know, my prognosis was still pretty grim. And I got great benefit from that. I mean, there were some lovely visuals, but I had quite a mild response in some ways. And my therapist said to me, I think you're more at peace with your mortality than you realise from the meditation. So that was sort of encouraging. And then I've just used microdosing as a little bit of a self-maintenance regime, which is quite subtle. And this is all kind of self-prescribed, I should add.
Out there on the national airwaves.
Yeah, look, I think the law enforcement agencies have better things to do than, you know, prosecute a cancer patient. Yeah.
You did have compassion for your urologist, but at a certain point, 4 years in, you did sack your urologist.
Yeah, I actually sacked my oncologist.
Oncologist?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big deal to sack your oncologist.
Yeah, I always joke, and I hope you aren't offended by this, Peter, I always say that I brought him in for a performance review and he hadn't hit his KPIs and I was going to have to let him go, you know. But, yeah, we'd had a couple of I think the final straw for me was I'd been seeing him for 4 years and I was being really proactive. I was doing all these things around diet and exercise and meditation and
psilocybin.
I didn't mention that. But I said to him, you know, and I don't use his real name in the book. I said, look, Stuart, I've been working really hard at this. I've been seeing you for 4 years. You know, how do you think I'm going? And he looked at me and he went, about average. You're about average. You know, some of my patients are doing worse, some are doing better. You're about average.
Diabolical.
And the funny thing was, in his waiting room, he had one of those motivational posters that said, trust your instincts. And I walked out of his office and I looked at that poster and I thought, okay, I'm not coming back. And so I found a new oncologist who I felt much more, was much more sort of simpatico and encouraging of the sort of lifestyle things I was doing for myself.
Tim Baker on sacking his first oncologist to find one who understood Tim's need for agency as he navigated a very tough prostate cancer treatment regime. I wonder if you relate to his story. You're with Big Ideas across Australia on ABC Radio National and as podcast on the ABC Listen app. I'm Natasha Mitchell. GP and award-winning novelist, librettist and poet Dr. Peter Goldsworthy couldn't help but turn to words when he was diagnosed with myeloma, a type of blood cancer.
You, Peter Goldsworthy, had nocturnal poetic emissions. Now we're going right there now, aren't we?
So that's a blame and dexamethasone. It's interesting what you're talking about despair. I didn't consciously ever feel anything like that, but I would sometimes wake up in the morning and find I'd written a poem or something in the middle of the night that seemed to come from a darker part of the brain. And sometimes I'd be surprised by that. But then I think poetry does connect. I mean, one of the things I love about poetry is it does seem to connect to something that's almost pre-verbal. I mean, we don't think in words. You know, we think in thoughts and feelings and music and body, you know, muscular feelings and things as well as sort of concepts. And I think poetry gets there. But so I sometimes be surprised by that. The nocturnal poetry emissions came from I got rung up urgently one morning by a sleep physician who'd done a overnight sleep study in the sleep lab on one of my patients. And she demanded to be put through because it was a sort of, it sounded like, you know, a crisis. And I said, she said, is, you know, such and such your patient? Has he had any history of mental health problems? And I said, no. And I said, why? And she said, well, because he masturbated during the sleep study. She thought it might be, you know, sexomnia things, think whatever. And I was just thinking, good Lord, has she got brothers? You know, I mean, don't a lot of men do that to help sleep? And,
just not when they've got the cameras of a sleep study on.
Anyway, I ran with that riff. That's where I was imagining her doing a sleep study on me later, and then she ringing up urgently saying, "What were you doing at 2:05 and or 3 p.m. at 3 a.m. And I'm saying nocturnal poetry emissions, because they would. I'd get up on decks. You kind of
But it was interesting because you weren't You write a lot. You have a dedicated writing practice alongside your GP practice. You weren't writing angry thoughts during the day, but you were writing. You were writing angry poems by night.
Yeah, but then maybe it was in that sense of therapeutic. It'd be over, and you know, then I'd wander down and empty and eat all the cheese in the fridge or whatever, and I'd go to bed happy. But dex is an interesting drug. Dexamethasone is an interesting drug, and I mean, I still take it. I take it monthly or last few months weekly again, but I am sick of it, finally. I am a bit sick of cancer, finally. I'm sick of writing about it, so I don't. I'm here. I am talking about it, yeah. And I don't want to. I'm enjoying it here today with you, Tim, and the audience.
And listening to Tim's story about his experience of rather cold interactions with specialists. What's that about, do you think? In your own training, where did you learn about how to be fully human with your patients?
Look, I think I don't know that. I got into medicine by being, you know, good at mental arithmetic, basically, which is what my generation did. I mean, so I don't, and I was a nerd scientist. I don't think I was that good. The medicine I loved most in the beginning was emergency medicine, problem, solution, you know, an algorithm. And you haven't got time to form emotional attachments with people in extremis, whether it's, you know, trauma, road trauma or heart attacks or whatever. And that suited me, I think. Yeah. I think it's been it was a slow process. Writing helped. And you know, talking and working things through in fiction.
Did writing make you a better doctor?
Yeah, I think the other way, probably even, you know, certainly being a doctor gave me plenty of material to think about it. Writing for me is a way of thinking, maybe slow thinking, but you get there in the end. You find some answers slowly. There is also among doctors, you know, there's a certain caricature of surgeons as maybe they're more interested in the plumbing. There are wonderful surgeons. I'm not, you know, but some you happen to get a bung one, I think. I mean, I've got a very good friend who's a urologist in Adelaide, and one of the first things they take infinite time to separate the nerves out when they're doing a prostatectomy. That's so crucial to what we're talking about with sexual function. Also, that he's been for like 10 years or more giving, you know, trials of like long-acting Viagra, starting before surgery and well after, very, very aware of that problem. And I know he's a very compassionate person, but you do get plenty of sort of semi-autistic
Tim, I think at one point one of your urologists who was more complimentary in their approach and integrative said, most urologists think of their patients as cancer patients as a vesicle for the tumour.
Yeah, delivery systems for their tumours. Yeah, it was at an integrative oncology conference I went to, and I did hear a joke about oncologists that what's the difference between oncologists and God? God doesn't think he's an oncologist. Sorry, mate. And look, I mean, there's obviously a whole spectrum of experiences, and I've had some really positive interactions with the medical profession, and they've been incredibly receptive to my book.
In fact, you just got a call from an email from a fourth year medical student recently, and what did they say?
Well, she told me the book has changed the way she will practice medicine, so that was pretty wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah, and now I've recently taken up a role as a research fellow at Monash University's prostate cancer research group. So I'm a patient voice for their kind of research. So I sit in on these scientific meetings and hear about the new treatments they're developing, and I'm sure there are people in the room with a diagnosis. It's incredibly heartening to hear about all the work that's been going on in this area, and there are new treatments being developed all the time. So I guess my message is one of hope, that our job is to look after ourselves and stay fit and healthy for as long as possible. And, you know, it is a similar scenario to the one you described, Peter, where you stay in a treatment for as long as it remains effective. And it's been described to me as like being a frog in a lily pond. And you stay in a lily pad as long as it can support you. And when you start to sink, you jump to the next lily pad. And there's a whole lot of really smart people who are furiously developing new lily pads for us.
Beautiful way of putting it.
And so our job is exercise, diet, meditation, all the things that we
meditation, exercise, diet and
sleep. Yeah.
But you talk about this, and I'll come to you on this, Peter, too, this false dichotomy between mainstream cancer treatment, radiation, chemotherapy, surgery and complementary treatments. And in making the case for medicine to think more deeply about evidence-based complementary treatments, you're saying that this would actually help a urologist, oncologist like your first one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the chapters in the book is called Physician, Heal Thyself.
I love that chapter.
It talks about particularly oncologists have a really awful kind of mental health profile statistically, high rates of suicide, high rates of drug and alcohol abuse, and they don't like to talk about it. They're less likely to seek help than the general population for mental health issues because they see it as some kind of career blot. And so I understand, you know, working in that area, I think there is a kind of compassion fatigue and that there's a self-protective thing not to become emotionally invested in every patient when you know you're going to lose a lot of patients. But I think, yeah, a lot of the things that would help their patients would also help them in terms of these allied health supports. And also if it is a self-protective mechanism, that sort of emotional distancing, it doesn't appear to work because they do have this awful mental health profile. And I think you talk about Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies.
It's an amazing book.
It's an incredible book.
A History of Cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about 1,000 pages long.
Yeah. But there's lots of people who make the argument that, you know, doctors might be better off, as you do, Peter, seeing your patients as human. Because that emotional distancing as a self-protective mechanism doesn't seem to be a successful strategy for them or their patients. And I think I say somewhere in the book that in the war on cancer, we are all patients and doctors kind of casualties of this war on cancer. And my PhD exegesis is entitled Towards a New Language of Cancer, and I want to change the way we kind of talk and think and write about cancer.
Mm. Let's come to you, Peter, on that. As you're listening to Tim, did having cancer, I wonder, make you a better doctor?
I think so. I mean, certainly I'm a better listener. My listening has slowly improved over the last 30, 40 years, I hope, but certainly now I'm much more. Look, I just love seeing them. What happened, though, it was a shock because I had, after stem cell transplant, I was told I'd never go back to first-line medicine by Naomi, she thought, because of my immune system.
And you sold your practice just days before.
Yeah, I was very lucky because it was just, I was only me. You don't get much for them, but I would have given, I didn't tell the person who bought it, I would have given it away. I mean, I didn't get much because there was sacking the staff and somehow getting thousands of case notes, you know, out into the world. Mm. But so I was lucky. But anyway, and then 6 months later, after I'd had time off and came through that, I found, you know, knocked me over the feather. I really missed them all and that extended family of the last 30, 40 years. And so Dara Kuku, who's a Nigerian guy, bought it, obviously wanted me to come back part-time. And so I just do the three mornings. I really enjoy it a lot.
What's changed in your interactions with patients? You're officially in remission, but you call it intermission.
It's always intermission, I think.
Yeah. But still very much writing and still practicing.
Yeah, I can't. I've had to reduce the hours a bit. I get tired. I think I'm much freer with them. I joke a lot more, but I've always joked with them. I think I listen to them better, though, when things are, you know, pretty serious and jokes are not a Band-Aid at all. But I don't see – I'm still – they're still triaged. I don't see people with fevers and, you know, as one patient said to me, you don't see anyone who's actually sick. I said, you know, if you get a heart attack or you saw your arm off, bring it along in an esky. Yeah, I'll see you. that's sort of look. I feel very relaxed and free with them.
Yeah,
because they, you know, I've realised that they. I mean, well, you alluded to it earlier. There have been several women, much older women, who said, "Look, I'm relying on you to see me out. You know, you can't." And one of them was very embarrassed. She had a lot of them had heard I had cancer, and this 90-year-old, very elegant, lovely lady, came in and. And said, Peter, I can't remember her exact words, but you're not leaving us, something like that. And I assumed she'd learned I had cancer because she said, because I need you to see me out. And then when I said, you've heard I've got cancer, she said, no, I had no idea. You must think I'm terrible. Because, in fact, she was just worried I was going to retire. On the other hand, another patient came in because the priest down the road had put me in his prayers, and so I got no idea how that that got out. It was very early on in the kind of... So you realise that you're loved too, and it's by most of them.
Yeah, there's an enduring sense of love in your book from your many grandchildren. At the time there were six, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten or something aged from your loving partner, and just infused with great love. And there's a wonderful line that you quote from the Greek poet Constantine Cavafis, Waiting for the Barbarians. And at the end of that poem is the line, "And what is to become of us now? Now there are no more barbarians." Those people were a kind of solution. And you say, a hateful illness can also become a kind of solution, an all-consuming, all-purpose reason for living.
It does. It can become like that. I think I use the analogy, the cancer itself can be like a rat in a loaf. You know, it eats away inside your brain, the knowledge of cancer. And it can become all-consuming. And I seen, and I was determined that wasn't going to happen. Yeah, the Cavafis poem is a very famous poem. I end with another Cavafis poem, the famous poem Ithaca, which many of you know. It's really about, the journey, not the arrival of Odysseus. Make sure you have a wonderful trip and don't think about the arrival. But the Romans are sitting around the Senate, and the barbarians, they're all trembling and terrified because the barbarians are to arrive. And then the last line... But wait, you know, messengers come from the frontier. The barbarians have been defeated. And what is to become of us now? There are no more barbarians. Yeah. And we do, there is a strange, it's a strange psychological truth, one of those paradoxical psychological truths that's been part of all of us, that having something to worry about, having something to obsess us, and it's not just cancer, you know, people can find a raison d'etre in all kinds of obsessions. And I do in the book, the other, because there's a lot of books I read or reread.
We haven't even touched on that. This wonderful, it's infused with literary influence.
One was Philip Roth's novel, Sabbath Theatre. And in the end of that, Mickey Sabbath, who's this, you know, one of his sort of horrible, wonderful characters, and he's driven by hate and Eros. And at the end, he's just, I think, okay, pissed on the grave of the woman he loved, for some reason, and he's, but he's then he's thinking of killing himself. That's as his final act after he does this, and it's a wonderful book, despite my little pricey that I just gave of it. It's stunning in its writing, but horrible as well. He's got a gun, and he's going to kill himself, and then he finds he can't do it, and the last lines, or among the last lines, are, "And he couldn't do it. Everyone he hated was here. Why would he kill himself?" And I just thinking of the kind of barbarians that the different barbarians we have and hold on to, who were threatening us, and cancer among them. That just seemed another riff with him.
Tim, you at the end describe cancer as a kind of spiritual tinnitus and a superpower. How has it been a superpower?
I think it's one of those things that makes all those old cliches ring true, you know, not sweating the small stuff, and puts a lot of things in perspective. I mean, I've taken my diagnosis as kind of carte blanche to just do all the things I enjoy most. You know, my life is wonderful. And no one's really going to quibble with a cancer patient kind of pursuing their bliss. You know, I think there's a great liberation in that.
Yeah.
I remember coming in from a surf one day with one of my mates, and he said to me, are you working today? And I stopped and thought about it. I went, if it fits into my lifestyle, I think I might do a bit. I do feel like it's given me this great liberation to just live a pretty idealistic life on the beach. One of my neighbours is a fisherman, another one is a surfboard shaper. They call by when they have surplus stock, and so I invest in fresh fish and quality surfboards.
It's my living your bliss.
It's my financial strategy. So, yeah, life's good. And I think that's one of my messages too, that, you know, there is life after even a really dire cancer diagnosis. I think I have a lot of privilege in terms of being able to do a job that is very flexible. But, yeah, I just do the things that bring me most joy as much as possible.
I think we've got time for maybe one question. I realise we could have many more, but does anyone have a question or a comment that they'd like to make?
Tim, how did you tell your children?
And the question was, just for the tape, Tim, how did you tell your children?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was largely taken out of my hands because when I got the diagnosis, my then father-in-law took the kids for the afternoon so that my then wife and I could sort of discuss the diagnosis, and he dropped them back at the end of the day. And I remember I was sitting on the couch, and my nine-year-old son at the time, Alex, came walking up to me, and him standing and me sitting were at eye level, and he must have overheard something in the course of the day because he just walked straight up to me and went, "Have you got cancer? Have you, Dad?" And I went, "Yeah, mate, I do." You know, I look back and I think, I don't think we got it quite right. You know, I didn't want them to live with this anxiety. And I sometimes had this, I somehow had this kind of, I think, naive optimism that somehow I was going to be okay. And I mean, I've already outlived my prognosis, and the kids are now 18 and 22, so I can have a much fuller conversation with them now.
And it was a process of you had times when you were really angry, when you were really depressed, when, yeah, it was really rough. You were really excavating
your
soul.
It was a huge impact.
Lots of wake-up calls for you about family.
In fact, you know, the mother of my children, my then wife, and I separated about 2 months before the book came out. So that's the sort of toll it took on family life. And my daughter, who's now 22, you know, I have some regrets because she says, you know, the messaging that we were getting, that, you know, you were so kind of positive and determined that you were going to be okay, it seemed to jar with the emotional energy in the household, that there was something grimmer going on than we were sort of talking about. And so if I had my time over again, maybe I would have been more candid. But it's really difficult. Every instinct as a parent is to protect your children.
Yeah. Peter, you are surrounded by kids, being a grandparent and having kids of your own as well. How did you approach those conversations with family? Initially, you didn't tell your partner what was going on.
Oh, that's 3 days. As soon as I got the positive result, I told her. And then the lovely little story I tell about my two granddaughters, who then were 4 and 6, and so I'd pick them up from school as per usual, and the 4-year-old Noonie said, "Pop, you got cancer?" I said, "Yep." She said, "Oh, okay," and turned back to, you know. And but one thing I would recommend that my son organised, you know, because I was going to lose all my hair after you, with a stem cell transplant, you're given this infusion of a drug called melphalan, which kills all your blood cells.
It's like a ground zero moment for you, isn't it?
And it's even, they have a sort of day zero calendar with. So we knew I was going to lose my hair. So Daniel organised, and his sons who are half African, have these sort of afro that he's always shaving and doing. So he said, "Look, let's have a ceremony. Come around." Everyone came around, my mum too, who hadn't seen my bald head since that popped out. I wrote a poem about this, since this sudden new thigh appeared, but, you know, 70 years ago. Daniel shaved the boys, as he normally does, you know, sort of, you know, afro mohawks, whatever. And then he shaved me to a mullet and then shaved me
Love
completely. And so I reckon, you know, talking about having control, have a control of losing your hair, just shave it. Lose your hair in your own time.
Let's end on a poem.
I was talking about poems that pop out in the middle of the night and you wake up and you think, where did it come from? This is one from very early called Tomorrow. I loved Tomorrow from the first day we met, her secret promises, her sweet backward glances. She was always the last thing on my mind before sleep. She made me feel special. Often we talked all night, her hopes and plans for us, our future together. Years passed, passion faded, I began to take Tomorrow for granted. At times she disappointed me, at times we quarrelled, but when I needed a hand, hers was always there for me, reaching back over difficult midnights, hauling me across. When did we begin to grow apart? When did she start telling me lies? When did I wake to find Tomorrow had no time left for me at all?
Peter Goldsworthy, Tim Baker.
Such wonderful reads. I cannot recommend them enough. Whether or not you're living with a cancer diagnosis or know someone who is, Tim Baker's memoir is called Patting the Shark, A Surfer's Journey, Learning to Live Well with Cancer, and Dr. Peter Goldsworthy's memoir, is called The Cancer Finishing School. You can find Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app and tell your friends about the podcast too. I'm Natasha Mitchell, bringing big thinkers at the best live events right here on Big Ideas. I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.